Most of those who believe they should stop find it very difficult to do so. They find it's become a deeply ingrained habit, a habit they can't change just because they want to.
Jeremy Toogood reads Red Gauntlet by Sir Walter Scott.
Hello. The sunset was dying over the hills of Solway Firth. The lone piper on the battlements of Edinburgh Castle was saluted.
The sunset was dying over the hills of Solway Firth. The lone piper on the battlements of Edinburgh Castle was silhouetted against the
crimson streak sky. In the shadows of Corrigan. In the shadows of Cairngorm,
the lone piper on the battlements of Edinburgh Castle.
Next. Here, on top of Edinburgh Castle, in conditions of extreme secrecy, men are being trained for the British Army's first kamikaze regiment, the Queen's Own Kamikaze Highlanders. So successful has been the training of the kamikaze regiment that their numbers have dwindled from 30,000 to just over a dozen in 3 weeks. What makes these young Scotsmen so keen to kill themselves?
The money's good.
And the water skiing.
Tension!
All right, Sergeant Major, that is. Now, how many chaps you got left?
Six, sir.
Six.
A five, sir. Good luck, Johnson.
Jolly good, sir, Sergeant Major. Well, I've come here to tell you we got a job for your five lads.
Four, sir.
For your four lads.
Good luck, Taggart.
Now, this mission's going to be dangerous and it's going to be tough, and we're going to need every lad of yours to pull his weight. Now, which four are they?
Are these three here, sir? Okay, off you go, Smith. Right!
Sergeant Major.
Sir!
You don't think it might be a good idea to stop the training program for a little bit?
They've got to be trained, sir. It's a dangerous job.
Yes, I've heard that, Sergeant Major.
All right, McPherson, you're next. Off you go. Right.
You see, what is worrying me, Sergeant
Major? I'll make you a good one, sir. Good lad, McPherson.
McPherson, only this mission really is very dangerous. We're going to need both the chaps that you've got left.
Both of you, sir.
Sergeant Major, what's this man's name?
This one, sir. This one's MacDonald, sir.
MacDonald. No. Hang on to MacDonald, sir. Hang on to him.
I don't know whether I can, sir. He's in the state of Mitsubishi Kyoko Mitsunawa.
What's that?
It's the fifth state Scotsman can achieve, sir. He's got to finish himself off by lunchtime, or he thinks he's let down the emperor, sir.
Well, can't we get him out of it?
Oh, I don't know how to, sir. See, our kamikaze instructor, Mr. Yashimoto, was so good he never left Tokyo Airport.
Well, there must be someone else who can advise us.
Good morning. Kamikaze, please.
Yes. Would you go through, please?
Thank you.
Fine, Sergeant Major. No time to lose.
Bit pardon, sir?
No time to lose.
No what, sir?
No time. No time to lose.
Oh, I see, sir. No time to lose, sir.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yes, no time to lose, sir.
Right.
Is that funny, sir? I've never come across that phrase before. No time to lose. 42 years I've been in the regular army, and I've never heard that phrase.
Well, it's in perfectly common parlance.
In what, sir?
Oh, never mind. Right, no time to lose.
Eventually, yes, sir.
What?
Well, like you said, sir, we'll be able to make time, eventually, without to lose, sir, no.
Look, I don't think you've quite got the hang of this phrase, Sergeant Major.
Morning. No time to lose. Now then, how are you thinking of using this phrase?
Well, I was thinking of using, like, good morning, dear. What is in no time to lose?
Yes, well, you've not quite got the hang of that, have you? No time to lose, no time to lose, no time to lose, no time to lose. Now, you want to use this phrase in everyday conversation, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yes, good.
My wife and I have never had a great deal to say to each other. In the old days, we used to find things to say, like, pass the sugar, or that's my flannel. But in the last 10 or 15 years, there just hasn't seemed to be anything to say. And anyway, I saw your phrase advertised in the paper, and I thought, that's the kind of thing I'd like to say to her.
Yes, well, what we normally suggest for a beginner such as yourself is that you put your alarm clock back 10 minutes in the morning so you can wake up, look at the clock, and use the phrase immediately. Shall we try it?
Yes.
All right, I'll be the alarm clock. When I go off, look at me and use the phrase, OK?
No! Time to lose.
No, no time to lose.
No time to lose.
No time to lose.
No time to lose.
No, to lose, like to lose in France. No time to lose.
No time to lose.
No time to lose.
No time to lose.
No, no time to lose.
No, no time to lose.
No time to lose. The story of the wild and lawless days of the post-impressionists.
All right, you yellow-bellied sidewinder, go for your guns.
Anyway, no time to lose, Sergeant Major.
Look out, sir! Go! Bravo! We'll have to hurry, sir! No, put that down! Put that down, lad! He's reached the sixth plane already, sir!
Right, well, here are the plans, Sergeant Major. Good luck.
For you, sir!
And good luck to you, MacDonald.
Thanks, sir. I'm calm, MacDonald. No time to lose.
Very good, Sergeant Major.
Yes, excellent.
So it was that on a cold November morning, RSM Erdoch and Sabre MacDonald, one of the most highly trained kamikaze experts the Scottish Highlands have ever witnessed, left on a mission which was to... Oh, I can't bother this trip.
Right, MacDonald. No time to lose.
Mission. Now, here's the method. RSM Erdoch will lull the enemy into a full sense of security by giving them large quantities of money, a good home, and a steady job. Then, when they're upstairs with a wife, Sabre MacDonald will hurl himself at the secret documents, destroying them and himself. Well, that's the plan. The time is now 1942 hours. I want you to get to bed, have a good night's rest, and be on parade early in the morning. Thank you for listening, and thank you for a lovely supper.
And Sue... So, intrepid RSM Erdoch and super
Sapper
MacDonald made their way to Wawa towards the Russian boulder.
And so
RSM Murdoch and Sabre MacDonald made their way towards the Russian boulder.
Boulder!
Penguins. Yes, penguins. What relevance do penguins have to the furtherance of medical science? Well, strangely enough, quite a lot. A major breakthrough, maybe. It was from such an unlikely beginning as an unwanted fungus accidentally growing on a sterile plate that Sir Alexander Fleming gave the world penicillin. James Watt watched an ordinary household kettle boiling and conceived the potentiality of steam power. Would Albert Einstein ever have hit upon the theory of relativity if he hadn't been clever? All these tremendous leaps forward have been taken in the dark. Would Rutherford ever have split the atom if he hadn't tried? Could Marconi have invented the radio if he hadn't by pure chance spent years working at the problem? Are these amazing breakthroughs ever achieved except by years and years of unremitting study? Of course not. What I said earlier about accidental discoveries must have been wrong. Nevertheless, scientists believe that these penguins, these comic, flightless, web-footed little bastards, they finally, unwittingly, help man to fathom the uncharted depths of the human mind. Professor Rosewall of the Laver Institute.
Hello! Here at the Institute, Professor Charles Passerell, Dr. Peaches Barkovitz, and myself have been working on the theory originally postulated by the late Dr. Kramer, that the penguin is intrinsically more intelligent than the human being. The first thing that Dr. Kramer came up with was that the penguin has a much smaller brain than the man. This postulate formed the fundamental basis of all of his thinking and remained with him until his death. Now, we've taken this theory one stage further. If we increase the size of the penguin until it is the same height as the man, and then compare the relative brain sizes, we now find that the penguin's brain is still smaller. But, and this is the point, it is larger than it was. For a penguin to have the same size of brain as a man, the penguin would have to be over 66 feet high. This theory has become known as the waste of time theory and was abandoned in 1956. Hello again. Standard IQ tests gave the following results. The penguins scored badly when compared with primitive human subgroups like the bushmen of the Kalahari, but better than BBC program planners. The BBC program planner's surprisingly high total here can be explained away as being within the ordinary limits of statistical error. One particularly dim program planner can cock the whole thing up.
These IQ tests were thought to contain an unfair cultural bias against the penguin. For example, it didn't take into account the penguin's extremely poor educational system. To devise a fairer system of tests, a team of our researchers spent 18 months in Antarctica living like penguins, and subsequently dying like penguins, only quicker, proving that the penguin is a clever little sod in his own environment.
Therefore, we devised tests to be given to the penguins in the fourth set. I do beg your pardon. In their own environment.
Shh! What is the next number in this sequence? 2, 4, 6. Did he say 8? What is...
The environmental barrier had been removed, but we'd hit another, the language barrier. The penguins could not speak English and were therefore unable to give the answers. This problem was removed in the next series of experiments by asking the same questions to the penguins and to a random group of non-English-speaking humans in the same conditions.
What is the next number? 2, 4, 6.
Hello?
The results of these tests were most illuminating. The penguin scores were consistently equal to those of the non-English speaking group.
These inquiries led to certain changes at the BBC. While attendances at zoos boomed.
Soon these feathery little hustlers were infiltrating important positions everywhere.
Quick!
Pravda, kada mi je to?
We must study them in conditions of absolute secrecy.
Yeah?
Look on!
Yeah?
And welcome to Spot the Loony, where once again we invite you to come with us all over the world to meet all kinds of people in all kinds of places and ask you to spot the loony. Our panel this evening, Gert Svensson, the Swedish mammal abuser and part-time radiator.
Good evening.
A Dame Elsie Occluded, historian, wit, bon vivant, and rear half of the Johnson brothers.
Good evening.
And Miles Yellowbird, up high in Banana Tree, the golfer and inventor of Catholicism.
Good evening.
And we'll be inviting them to spot the loony. Yes, quite right. A viewer from Preston there who's pointed out correctly that the entire panel are loonies. 5 points to Preston there, and on to our first piece of film. It's about mountaineering, and remember, you have to spot the loony.
The legendary south face of Ben McDooey. Dark, forbidding.
Yes, well done, Mrs. Nesbitt of York. Spotted the loony in 1.8 seconds. On to our second round, and it's photo time. We're going to invite you to look at photos of Tony Jacklin, Anthony Barber, Edgar Allan Poe, Katie Boyle, Reginald Maudling, and a loony. All you have to do is spot the loony. Now, I must ask you, please, not to ring in until you've seen all the photos. Yes, you're right. The answer was, of course, number two. I'm afraid there's been an error in our computer. The correct answer should, of course, have been number four, and not Katie Boyle. Katie Boyle is not a loony. She is a television personality. Now it's time for Spot the Loony historical adaptation. And this time it's the thrilling medieval romance Ivanhoe. A stirring story of love and war, violence and chivalry, set amidst the pageantry and splendour of 13th century England. All you have to do is spot the loony. Yes, well done, Mrs. L of Leicester, Mrs. B of Buxton, and Mrs. G of Gatwick. The loony was, of course, the writer, Sir Walter Scott.
I didn't write that. Sounds more like Dickens. You bastard.
Was he the greatest flowering of the early 19th century romantic tradition? The most underestimated novelist of the 19th century? Or merely a disillusioned and embittered man?
Please.
Yes.
Thank you.
These trees behind me now were planted over 40 years ago as part of a policy by the then Crown Woods, who became the Forestry Commission in 1924. The Forestry Commission systematically replanted this entire area. That's 40,000 acres of virgin forest. By 1980, this will have risen to 200,000 acres of soft woods. In commercial terms, a coniferous cornucopia, an evergreen Eldorado, a tree-lined treasure trove. No, a fat fir-cone future for the financiers. But what are the cost? Go away, in human terms. Who are the casualties?
For this was Sir Walter Scott's country. In many of his finest romances, such as Guy Mannering or Red Gauntlet... No, Scott showed himself to be not only a...
The spruces and firs of this forest will be used to create...
Also, a writer of humour and...
Britain's timber resources have been used up at the rate of over...
One man who knew Scott was Angus Tinker.
Much of Scott's greatest work, and I'm thinking here particularly of Heart of Midlothian and Old Mortality, for example, are concerned with preserving the life and conditions of...
Forestry research has shown that a wholly synthetic soft timber fibre can be created, leaving the harder trees, the oaks, the beeches, the larches, and the pines, and even some of the deciduous hardwoods. This new soft timber fibre would totally replace the pine woods, fastboards, and chipboards at present dominating the... In the Waverly Knolls, Scott was constantly concerned to protect a way of life. Aspirations within the necessary limitations of the Gothic novel, so explore the torturous and at times self-destructive soul.
Developments of reinforced timber.
In Scott living in Abbotsford, in the heart of the country,
Maplewood and Rosewood veneers on
pot. A subjugated country, as Scott.
An increase in the Canadian timber exports, which were still recovering from the effects of two unsuccessful Jacobite revolts. For wooden pulp adhesives.
In Rob Roy and also in
Old Scotland. But a decline in hearts.
Scott was at pains to emphasize the.
Then, Ned?
Then.
The end. The end.
Next week on Book at Bedtime, Jeremy Toogood will be reading Anna Sewell's Black Butt... Black Butum... Black Butum...